The third step on the transcendental dependent origination is joy. Now you have to remember that this is dependent arising, which means one first cause has a result. So the first thing was realizing dukkha, but not just having it. Everybody has it. That's not enough. But realizing what it actually means, that it is part of existence, that it is inherent in everything, and that the world cannot alter that for us. And that understanding brings then the faith, the confidence in a path. And having gained that faith and confidence, joy arises. One brings the next. These three are the necessary preconditions for meditation. The next steps that I will talk about that come as a follow-up in the dependent arising are about meditation. But these are the three necessary preconditions. So now, joy. The joy that comes from having this confidence in a path, the joy that comes from having found something that will take one out of the worldly problems, that promises total liberation and release. That joy should be strong enough to give one an inner feeling that does not alter whether outer conditions are pleasant or not. Because we have already understood that outer conditions only concern our sense contacts. Everything that's outside of us are sense contacts. Now, unless we have understood that, we're going to waver badly back and forth whether we should keep on this spiritual path or maybe get married, or maybe go to university, or take a trip, or have a biological garden and eat only biological food. There's going to be an enormous wavering, because that is the precondition for knowing that this is the only thing that takes one out of dukkha. Nothing else. And for that it is necessary to realize without a shadow of a doubt that everything else is a sense contact through any one of our senses. And because it is a sense contact, it has no inherent value. It comes and it goes. It doesn't mean it's bad, but it has no inherent value in it. There's nothing in it that one can hang on to, that one can keep. The Buddha described the sense contacts as being gross, as being something that is of a gross nature. So once we realize that our sense contacts cannot satisfy us, and that there's nothing outside of us that is not a sense contact, and it needs to be investigated and found out whether this is so or not. Once this has happened as an understanding, then there is no question about being joyful, having a spiritual path. This inner joy is an absolute necessity for successful meditation. And I'm sure that most of you have already proven that within yourselves. Meditation does not work unless there is that even feeling inside of no bother, no problem, no worry, no wish. In order to meditate properly, the Buddha's words start out with secluded. But that word is very often misunderstood. People think it means that you have to sit in a cave somewhere, or that you have to leave behind all human contact. It doesn't mean that at all. It means secluded from sense contacts. That's all it means. Being secluded from sense contacts, we can start meditating. But in order to do that, there has to be this inner feeling of happiness, of ease, this understanding of contentment in oneself, that this is what we're doing, is the best thing one can possibly do. If we have such joy within us, then of course, not only will we continue on this path and have the meditation work for us, but also we have this joy with us all the time. It doesn't just arise when we sit down on the pillow, or just arise when we remember something about the past. It is a part and parcel of one's inner being, having found the way out of the human problems. That we haven't actually got to the end of that yet doesn't matter. But having found a way, there is not a single person in the world one can say that doesn't want to be happy. That includes us. Happiness, therefore, is our goal. We want to be happy. Now here, in this spiritual path, we've been shown that there is a way. So having been shown the way is like getting a map to a destination. It's a destination that we want to go to. It's a destination that we haven't been to yet. We don't know exactly what it looks like. But it is certainly something we want to go to have, our goal. So now here's a map. Somebody has given us this map. Isn't that cause for joy, gratitude, devotion? It must give rise in the heart to a feeling of being blessed. Unless that feeling arises, the meditation is going to be off and on, an off and on affair. It need never be an off and on affair. Once it has been established, it can be steady. If it does become steady, it is a great jewel that we can carry around with us. Joy can arise from this cause alone, from knowing we've been given a pathway which we can follow. And we can trust that pathway because so many have already followed it to its end and have had the blessing of reaching their goal. But there are other means of arousing joy in oneself. And joy is not pleasure. Pleasure comes through the senses. And pleasure is very short-lived. It doesn't mean we shouldn't have any pleasure. We will. We will have pleasure in sense contacts until equanimity has become so strong that the pleasure is also just a pleasant feeling. But pleasure and joy are two entirely different feelings. We can help ourselves on this path by making joy arise through making good karma. And this making of good karma, quite deliberately, being there for others. When our intention is helping and supporting others, and we put our full attention on that, obviously our attention at that time has been removed from ourselves. No problem can arise when we do not put our attention on the one who has the problems. And being able to do something for others, whether the other person is grateful or not, has nothing to do with it. But being able to do something for others arouses joy in the heart, contentment and satisfaction, knowing that one has done one's utmost. The Buddha mentions 10 paramis, 10 virtues, which we need to cultivate and foster, and at the top of the list is generosity. Being there for others is generosity. Generosity of time, of attention, of love, of compassion, of being a medium for their happiness. Now when we can see, even actually see, that this has come about, our joy will be even greater. But even when the other person's happiness is not apparent, if we know that our best intention for the other was there, it is impossible not to feel joyful. The joy that comes from knowing one has done one's best also comes from knowing that one is keeping discipline. Discipline must always be self-discipline. It can never be imposed discipline, because imposed discipline is irksome, and it appears to be like a chain, and one will automatically resist it and reject it or feel hampered by it. So whatever discipline we are keeping, we are imposing it upon ourselves, for the simple reason that we can rejoice in the fact that we're conquering ourselves. The Buddha said, the one who conquers 1,000 times 1,000 armies is like nothing compared to the one who conquers him or herself. That's self-discipline, conquering oneself. Our instincts are all against it. Our instincts are constantly reaching out towards sense pleasures. It is our very first hindrance out of the 5, which I will describe tomorrow. The gratification of our senses is the very first and foremost reaction that we have to everything that goes on. Conquering some of that means that we can rejoice in the fact that we are a warrior on the way to liberation. This way to liberation is not a battle, because if it's a battle, it becomes most unpleasant. But one needs to be a warrior. And a warrior is one who is courageous. A warrior is one who is honest about oneself, to oneself. We don't have to go around telling others. To ourselves we're honest. And have the courage and the honesty gives us strength, the strength to impose the self-discipline. All that puts joy into our heart, the joy of knowing that we're actually removing ourselves from that base and always full of problems, ordinary human life, which we have already tasted to its full and have never yet made it work to the point of full satisfaction. Knowing that we have turned ourselves away from that and turned in a different direction gives one the strength to continue. Naturally, this is not an easy path. There's a story about the Buddha before he became enlightened, when he was still the Bodhisattva. He had been fasting and had realized that exaggerated asceticism was not the path. That's why his path is called the middle path, the middle way. And he decided that he was going to eat normally again. And the story says that he sat under what we now know to be the Bodhi tree in what is now called Bodh Gaya. And a woman came by the name of Sujata, and she had been praying to that tree to have a child, because it was known in the area that there was a deva living in that tree that was helpful in such matters. So she had been praying to this deva in the tree, and she had had a child and was very, very happy. So she had sent out her maid to find out or to make sure that she could make an offering to that tree, because she had promised that if she was going to have a baby, then she would make an offering to this tree. So she sent out the maid to prepare all this, make a preparation under the tree. And when the maid got there, she saw the Bodhisattva sitting under the tree, and she thought it was the tree deva. So she ran home to her mistress, Sujata, and told her that the tree deva was sitting under the tree. So Sujata decided to hurry up and prepare the offering. And the story says that she milked 100 cows, and she gave the milk of the 100 cows to drink for 50 cows. Then she milked 50 cows and gave that milk to 20 cows. Then she milked the 20 cows and gave the milk to 10 cows. And then she milked the 10 cows and gave the milk to drink to one cow. And when she milked the last cow, it was pure cream that came out. And then she cooked rice in this pure cream. And then she filled a golden bowl with this rice. And she went with this bowl of golden bowl and rice to the tree. And there was what she thought was the tree deva, which was actually the Bodhisattva. And she offered this rice and the golden bowl to him and said that he should also keep the golden bowl. So he ate the rice, which in Sinhalese is called kiribat, which means milk rice. Kiri is milk, and bat is rice. And on every holy or festive occasion, this is now offered to people and to visitors and to travelers. So he ate the rice, and then he took the golden bowl, and he said he will throw it in the river behind him. And if it would swim downstream, he would not get enlightened. If it would swim upstream against the current, he would become enlightened. So obviously it must have swum upstream. Although one cannot imagine that a golden bowl would swim upstream. But what it really means is this is a symbolic story which is really important to us. It means following the Dhamma all the way to enlightenment means swimming upstream. When we swim downstream with the current, it is much easier. Everybody swims downstream. All the people going in that direction. But where do we end up? In the mud of the mud flats that lead into the ocean. But when we swim upstream against the current, first of all, we are alone. And secondly, we have to work much harder. But we come to the source, because the source of the river is upstream. So it is our good fortune to know about it. And we have to take into account that it is a much more difficult thing than going along with all the rest of humanity. But not only that, but swimming downstream means going along with our own instinct and impulses. That is going downstream. So whenever we have those desires, whenever we have those ideas, whenever the joy of the path has disappeared, we must remember that that is the natural, instinctive human behavior from which we are trying to sever ourselves. And as we sever ourselves from it, what we get is the renewed joy of being able to do it. So, not only do we have the understanding of the path, we have the understanding of the beauty of it, we have the understanding of so many, many others having been able to reach their goal by swimming upstream. But we also have this feeling in us that we are extending our power, our strength, the whole way. We are not weak. We are not giving in. We are using our complete strength, everything we've got. Now everyone has different abilities. They need to be used, whatever they are. Everyone has some particular skills that they can use on this path. Some people are very good at being calm and collected. Other people are very good at analysis. Some people can remember very well. Some people can write very well. We need to use our abilities and extend them to the fullest. There are five spiritual qualities which, when we use them correctly, become five spiritual powers. First, they are indriyas, which are faculties. And when we use them and cultivate them, they become bala, which means power. And when we have them as powers, they will make it possible for us to go the whole way. It is simple to understand. It is simple to know. It's not easy to do. The simplicity of the path is something that the Buddha very much approved of. He wanted it to be simple. because our minds are complicated. And the more we complicate it, the more difficult we find it. But the simplicity of using those faculties which we have to make them powers also should show us that joy can be part of the everyday experience of practice. And it is not, this joy is not a sort of very strong passion. It is just an inner feeling of being in the right place at the right time and doing the right thing with one's whole being. That makes it joyful. The five spiritual faculties are compared to a team of horses, where there is a lead horse and two pairs. Now the lead horse can go as fast or as slow as it likes, but the two pairs have to be balanced. They have to be balanced because otherwise the cart will topple. The lead horse is mindfulness. That is the faculty which we all have. If we didn't have it, we'd long be run over by the first car that came along. We have the faculty of it, but we must make it a power. To make it a power means to keep remembering to use it. When walking, when standing, when sitting, when opening a door, when closing, when moving this way or that way, to remember. Naturally, we'll forget. But the minute the mind says, oh, I have forgotten to be mindful, is the time when we remember again. Without mindfulness, we will also not become aware of the joy within us about the past. Because mindlessly, we will be looking for sensual gratification through our sense contacts. Mindfully, we won't do that. Mindfully, we will know that we've had so many sensual gratifications in this life alone, and none of them ever did it, that we will mindfully remember that it isn't necessary to look for another one. But instead, watch our actions, watch our movements, watch our feelings and our thoughts. So mindfulness is that which leads us along. It is the one thing that has that capacity. It is a mental formation which is objective, not subjective, and without it, life is not safe. We are constantly in the danger of being drowned by emotions, of reacting unskillfully. The two pairs are, the first pair I've already mentioned is the one that faith and wisdom. They go together. Faith, which is the second step on the depend origination which I'm speaking about, has to be coupled with wisdom. Faith is that which leads us to devotion, to total commitment, and wisdom helps us to know whether we are devoted and committed to that which is true. Unless we know that, our faith is ill-placed. And the next pair, the second pair, is energy and concentration. If one has too much energy, there will be no concentration because it results in restlessness. It is mental and physical restlessness. And everybody experiences it sometimes. And if there is a lot of physical energy, then the restlessness needs to be removed through physical activity. If there's a lot of mental energy, which means thinking, 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 then one needs to use that up in doing something productive with it. But the concentration in the meditation needs to be totally balanced with that energy, because if there's too much concentration, then the energy will lapse and there will be a lack of attention awareness. Concentration, too much concentration, can also lead to drowsiness. So we need to balance constantly. And this is very typical of this path. It's a balancing act. It's a balancing act all the time. It's a balancing act of loving oneself and being there for others. It's a balancing act of our energy being used in the right way so that concentration can happen, and keeping it going, the energy, so that the concentration is the experience, but the energy makes it possible to understand the experience. The balancing between faith and wisdom means the balance between heart and mind, that which we know and that which we feel. Unless we use this path in the right way, it can be like that snake. It can bite us. Spiritual materialism. One of the best descriptions of that danger. Heart and mind need to be balanced. The mind understanding what we're doing, but the heart is the one that feels. This path can only be trodden through our feelings. We can understand what it's all about if we don't feel it. It's a philosophical exercise and belongs at the university. This is not a philosophical exercise. This is a feeling which changes us from the ordinary worldling, the Puttajana, to a noble one, to an Aryan. But it has to be through feeling. And joy is the first feeling that's necessary in order to be on this path. If we don't enjoy it, why should we do it? Very few people would continue something that they don't enjoy. And not enjoying it would mean that we haven't seen its beauty. So we haven't opened ourselves enough to it. So it is possible for us through seeing the absolute truth of it, through our joy in our own self-discipline, in our own strength, in using our faculties to become powers and to make good karma, to have constant joy within. And this joy need never be marred by outer circumstances. As long as we are dependent on outer circumstances, we are in a dependency situation, and to be dependent is against all freedom. This is a path that leads to freedom. To be dependent on outer circumstances can never help us. On the contrary, it binds us. We need to find the inner strength to be dependent on nothing except that which we can arouse in ourselves. So the first three steps on the transcendental dependent origination are the preconditions for meditation: dukkha, faith, joy. And tomorrow I will start on explaining the meditative path as the Buddha explained it in this dependent origination, but also in all his other discourses on meditation.